25 minutes after 8 o'clock on KMTI and our monthly edition with St. Pete County Commission, an opportunity to come on. We have Commissioner Steve Lund with us today, and also via phone joining us is Bob Widener. He is a lobbyist for many rural Utah counties. In fact, we'll explain that a little bit. Our subject for you listeners, we want you to know it can be complicated. We'll try to simplify that a bit this morning for you here because it's something very important to understand. And so basic understanding then really helps out on this here to kind of have the context for it all. So first off, we're going to go to Steve. We call it Secure Rural Schools. They'll see the acronym a lot of times, SRS. Goes way back, a long history. This goes way, way, way back here to this. So let's do a little history lesson, Steve, to first get the place to where our listeners can understand that background over time.
Great. Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here, and we certainly appreciate Bob coming on board with us to help us understand this a little bit different or a little bit better. Secure rural schools is one of the ways that these rural counties in these public land states receive funding to operate their schools and to operate and to maintain their roads. The Secure Rural Schools was established back in the days of Teddy Roosevelt, and I just want to go through a few things with you. The Manti-LaSalle was established in 1903. The Dixie National Forest was established in 1905. Wasatch in 1906. Ashley 1908. Fish Lake 1908. Now keep those numbers in mind and those dates in mind. It's important because initially the forests were considered forest reserves in 1891. And for the next, over the next 6 years of 1891 to 1897, there were more than 4 million acres of forest lands that were placed in the reserves, and that number continued to grow. But the primary function of these lands were to help improve the water resources necessary for people to survive, to improve and protect the forests and the reserves, and furnish a continual supply of timber to the citizens of the United States for its development. And we still continue to develop. One of the primary ways that these monies were gathered and these forests were taken care of was through grazing, through timber, and through water resources and water wise use of water.
Basically, our support system.
It is. Yeah. This is our support system, and if we don't understand it, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
Grazing is essential to these forests, and so is logging. And if we do anything we can to slow those down, we hamper our economy, we hamper our health, and we hamper our security. In 1905, the forest reserves were then changed to the National Forests, and the Forest Service was founded. By the mid-1900s, there was 153 million acres that was set aside for forests. President Roosevelt, and a name that's familiar around here is Gifford Pinchot. He was the chief forest service, and we happen to have a ATV trail named after him. They were concerned that the opposition to this many acres being put under the National Forest was going to be a political problem for the future of their political party, and there would be a lot of opposition from rural counties. So they set aside a bill, or Congress approved a bill that specified that 25% of all revenues raised from the national forests would be sent to counties which contained these forests to be used for county roads and public schools. So it's critical that we understand that as we take care of the forests, we improve our schools and we create an economic uplift for our schools, and we continue to maintain our roads with SRS money. There was a compact, and it's important to understand that these funds are to mitigate for the removal of lands from the Economic Development Center. So as these lands were taken out of the Economic Center of the public, there had to be a way to also for these lands to be used for economic development in these rural counties. Bob, I'm going to go back to you, and I appreciate you being on with us, and just let you introduce yourself. Bob's been a lobbyist for San Pete County and for many of these counties for decades, and has done a great job.
So, Bob or Steve, either one, how did Utah end up with so much land in this? You know, we've had that rundown there and that history of it, but How did Utah get so much land grabbed into that? And when you take that plus national parks, which is a humongous amount of land in Utah, how did that happen? Was it just a one-time trigger, or did it eventually happen over time?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question, because we're kind of an accident of history. The 17 western states, everything west of Colorado, and including the Dakotas, for whatever reason, were never allowed to sell off their public lands the way the other states were upon coming into the Union. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's a whole entirely different subject. But we did end up with these lands, and Utah has 67%. We have 53 million acres of land in Utah, 8 million of which are national forest lands, 3 million of which are national park lands, and 20 plus million acres of BLM land. The rest is either state owned or private. And my recollection is the state owns about 10%, and the private lands are roughly 15 to 20%.
So in comparison, just we'll note here, just in comparison to other states, that's phenomenal. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot. The only states that have more than we do are Nevada in the 90% range, in Alaska.
Yeah.
Colorado's at about 50%, New Mexico 50%, Arizona is 60% and so forth. But it's all, as Steve was emphasizing, these federal lands, they not only need to be protected, but they need to be protected for the use of the people. And so the very best of the lands were deemed to be national park lands. The earliest lands set aside, as Steve very clearly laid out, were national forest lands. And then the leftover lands were BLM lands.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that kind of lays the groundwork for that. So let's talk about how this, now there's the phrase, listeners, revenue sharing. Keep that in mind here. We're talking about this from 1908. So Bob Widener will give us a little bit of a history of how this has evolved over a period of time here on this revenue sharing and what happened.
Well, the counties did rebel in after the lands were taken by an executive order by President Roosevelt. The counties rebelled, and Congress responded by saying, whatever revenues are produced on federal lands will be shared 25% with that county of origin. And as we talked about earlier, most of it is from timber, probably 90%, but it's also from grazing. It's also from other uses. And of course, mining is different. Mining is treated differently because there are two different categories for mining. We have hard rock minerals that are the discoverable minerals like gold, silver, copper, uranium, and so forth. And then we have what are called leasable minerals that Congress decided should be leased rather than simply having a miner go out with a pick and shovel and discover them. And that would include coal and oil and gas. And so the sources of revenue for these local governments today are mineral lease receipts, this 25% payment from timber, and Congress has subsequently created two different programs, Secure Rural Schools, which is an offshoot of the timber sale program, the historic timber sale program, and payment in lieu of taxes, PILT, which is essentially the federal government paying pennies on the dollar for property taxes, for requiring these local governments to provide services on lands that they don't own and can't tax.
Right.
But again, lest we get far afield, on Secure Rural Schools is a direct offshoot of the revenues that were produced off national forest lands.
Okay. So this kind of, this revenue sharing, okay, we look at it as a pie, and the piece of the pie kind of shrank, or the size of the pie, I guess better said, maybe the size of the pie over time. So kind of get us up to speed on that, Bob. What happened here with all of that, particularly in late 1980s and time since then?
Well, by the late 1980s, the Forest Service nationally cut 13.5 billion board feet of timber from all of the public land states, all the national forests, producing $2.5 billion to $3 billion in revenue for taxpayers. 25% of that was shared with counties. So by the late 80s, when Reagan was president and President George H.W. Bush took office, we were at our all-time high in revenue production for local governments producing off the land. At that time, the National Environmental Movement came in and attacked the core environmental laws and discovered a critter in the Northwest called the spotted owl. And by using the spotted owl through the Endangered Species Act, they were successful in essentially collapsing that timber industry so that by 2016, instead of producing 13.5 billion or cutting 13.5 billion board feet of timber, when President Obama left office, we were down to cutting 2 billion board feet of timber. So from 13 to 2 billion, the revenues dropped from $2.5 billion to $157 million. So, and instead of being a producer of revenue, the Forest Service became a huge consumer, all because the timber industry collapsed throughout the West.
Bob?
So Steve's going to insert something here then, Bob, on this point right here.
Bob, I just want to emphasize to everyone that in that time frame, when it went from $13 billion to $2 billion, that's a $9 billion shortfall in education and road improvements, or 25% of that $9 billion is the shortfall that our schools lost, that our students were. It was taken out of the effectively out of the brains of our students because they lost that. And I think people need to understand that when that happens, when we lose that, and when we encourage things like that are just so far afield of common sense, our children suffer from that.
Oh, absolutely. And just so we don't confuse the figures, the amount of timber cut was 13 billion board feet.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of revenue produced was $2.5 billion.
Yeah.
But still, we dropped from $2.5 billion to $157 million.
Million, yeah. That's just humongous. The bottom fell out of the bucket, what really happened right there. So very quickly here, I think it's important to know there's Title I, there's Title II, and Title III. Just could you briefly tell us what that means, Bob, when we talk about these
sure.
Title I, Title II, Title III?
So as after the collapse occurred, Congress said during that period of the late 1990s, when Bill Clinton was president and Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House, Congress passed a bill called the Secure Rural Schools Act, and that took the high three production year averages and said, all right, we'll take whatever receipts are still coming in and put it into a pile, and we'll supplement that out of the Treasury by direct borrowing to keep these counties whole. So they will have an average of their high three timber production years, and that will, and it turned out to be about $480 million in the year 2001.
So I think
Title I of that act was 85% of that will go to education.
Right.
And the other
15?
And the rest of it will go to roads.
Right.
So they split it 50% schools, 50% roads. That's Title I. Title II created something called resource advisory councils, where you get the local Kiwanis Club, the Chamber of Commerce, the county commissioners, the Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, a whole group of different players put into this Resource Advisory Council, and those funds are distributed on projects that everybody can agree upon.
Yeah, we call those racks around here is what we call them, those RACs.
Yeah, they're Resource Advisory Committees, and that's what they are.
Yeah.
And then the Title III goes directly into the county government coffers for forest management and fire prevention, so that the counties could actually acquire equipment to fight fires and essentially keep forest health and safety.
Yeah. So the reason I wanted to delineate those is so our listeners could understand here when we hear the phrase Title I, Title II, and Title III, that realizing this all ties in. So I think, Bob, let's go to a little bit of a timeline starting around 2007, because what happens here over this is the SRS authorization expired in 2006. So between Bob and Steve, we can kind of talk about what happened over about a 12-year period there from 2006 and 7 up till about a year ago. Because I think it's important to realize here for people to understand how iffy this is, how tentative that all is here.
Well, I can tell you because I was involved firsthand that after the 2006 elections, I went to incoming Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada, his staff, and I said, you guys are taking over. This law is expiring. The Secure Rural Schools Act was authorized for 6 years. It was expiring. It needed to go forward, and the payment in lieu of tax program had never been fully funded. I said, you have an opportunity, Senator Reid, to fully fund PILT, pay the federal property tax on these lands, even though it's a reduced rate, to get that done, and to fully fund and extend the forest payments, Secure Rural Schools monies. Credit, Senator Reid did both. He made it a very difficult prospect for many Republicans because he put it in the TARP bailout bill of 2008. Both Bob Bennett and Orrin Hatch voted for that, and that vote by Senator Bennett cost him his Senate seat because Mike Lee used it to run against him. Nevertheless, they voted for it. It passed. Those funds were included in the TARP bailout of 2008, and that lasted for another 4 years. And then it subsequently kept expiring.
Mm-hmm.
The counties continued to need it, but we found that we had to go find bills to attach it to, and Congress in 1 year chose a defense bill, another year chose a farm bill, another year chose a helium federal subsidy for helium to attach it to.
Oh my gosh.
So the other one was the Doc Fix bill, which was for Medicare. And all of these bills were simply vehicles that mm-hmm. could be used to extend the forest payment.
Yeah.
And that's where we are today.
So, Bob, you and some of yours were having to lobby every year. I guess that's good for lobbyists, huh? It kept you busy.
Well, it did, but it's a royal pain.
Yeah.
There are a lot of other things we could be working on.
I know. I'm being facetious, so... on that. Okay. You know, there are just a few things we need to really understand here. And Steve can chip in on this one as well. Some talking points we want to cover here. And that is trying to get counties out west, out of a situation they're in and into more viable situation. And this is federal court, not kind of thing here. So let's address that a bit.
There is a, The counties in these public land states are working through what they call RS-2477 roads. And RS-2477 roads are typically historic roads that were created either to help ranchers water their cows or mm-hmm. prospectors find claims or timber people to log in the forests. But these RS-2477 roads are critical to us, and I wanted to make the tie here. If we have secure rural schools and we have the opportunity to receive money and fundings for our students and our children and also for our roads within the county, we have to have the ability to access those resources. And in order to access those resources, we have to use historic roads, mm-hmm. like RS-2477 roads. And I wanted Bob to give us just a little bit of a history and some of the critical reasons why we need our legislators, why we need Representative McAdams and Representative or Congressman Stewart and Congressman McAdams, why we need our congressmen and our senators to really take serious our RS-2477 roads. In Juab County and in Beaver County and Millard County and Sanpete County and Emery County, all of these counties, these roads are critical for our livelihood, and we need to make sure we keep them open.
Yeah, the phrase we use around here is locked out, kind of a scenario when that's not accessible. It's accessibility here. So that's that connection there. Any additional thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, yeah. When I went to work for Senator Jake Garn, and he's the one that brought me back here to Washington, in 1978, one of the first issues that came up was county roads. Congress had just passed a law called the Federal Land Policy Management Act, FLPMA. And in that bill, the policy of the United States changed from one of disposing of lands to retaining of lands, and that included road rights of way as well. So they essentially, RS-2477 was, look at it this way, during the Lincoln administration, he was focused on the civil fight, prosecuting the Civil War, but one of the things he doesn't get a lot of credit for outside of Western circles is creation of the Homestead era laws.
Mm-hmm.
The Homestead Act and subsequent laws were put into place so that he could essentially settle the West. And one of those laws was a self-executing law called Revised Statute 2477, which essentially allowed all the roads of the West in the public land states to be created. And from that period in 1866 to 1976, when that Federal Law Land Policy Management Act passed, that's how the West was settled. And in the FLPMA Act, the road rights-of-way issue, those roads that had been discovered and were in use were grandfathered in. And all, as Steve mentioned, all these counties are trying to do is retain those roads that were created for public purposes. And that's the dynamic of what these road rights of way are all about.
Yeah. There's a lot of, we don't have time to detail it, so a lot of burden of proof things that have been and probably will be part of that as the battle goes on. County Commissioner Steve Lund is our guest, along with lobbyist Bob Widener today. There are some myths out there, some false narratives, some propaganda on these RS-2477. I think if we briefly touch on those, we don't have time to go real in-depth. We might do that on a future table talk, Steve. But
yeah.
I think if we can just touch on some of those myths out there that are used for those false narratives, that would be good to address that briefly if we could here. Can I just
add one bit of context to this? I think will help.
Sure. Yeah.
We've all heard of historic Route 66.
Yeah.
That runs from Chicago to Los Angeles. When it hits New Mexico and Arizona and California, currently, if you look at a Bureau of Land Management master title plat or a map, their map showing where the roads are within the areas that they administer, nowhere does Route 66 appear on their maps.
Yeah.
That is the largest single RS-2477 right-of-way there is. And everyone drives it. It's there. It's been there for most of the last century, and yet it doesn't appear on the BLM maps. Why? Because that RS-2477 law never required BLM to issue you a piece of paper saying that that road right-of-way was theirs. So that's the frustration counties have today, is that while they're not all Route 66s, some of them are interstate highways, some of them are state highways, but for the fact that they exist, there's no tape proving it. So when you get into the remote areas and some of the dirt roads that are favorites for deer hunting and going out and watering the fields, there's no proof that road existed. And so that's the frustration that we're trying to resolve with legislation here in Congress, to say, hey, if that road existed and we can prove that it existed, you got to show us a piece of paper that, yes, it does exist.
Yeah, and you're talking about legal fees and a lot of other things that enter in there. So, okay, yeah, that's a good context for that. So some of the myths then that are out there that are perpetuated, let's just address those briefly if we could here.
Well, the National Environmental Movement has made a fortune in scaring people by putting pictures of Caterpillar D8 tractors in front of Delicate Arch, showing that Grand County intends to cave over Delicate Arch. And people here in the East are very susceptible to that kind of political campaign. The fear tactic works beautifully, when in fact, no such thing was ever proposed. If there was a road in southern Utah from point A to point B, and it existed prior to 1976, that should be that county's road, because the county maintains it. The county pays to go out and keep it available for the public to use. But it's not, and nobody has ever intended on paving the entire West and all of the dirt roads that are out there.
Yeah.
So it's a fear tactic, and we're just trying to overcome that by saying, all right, let's create a simple process whereby BLM evaluates the data. Does the road exist? Was it in continuous use under Utah law or under each respective Western state's law? And so it's forced that you keep maintaining it and you improve it as required by law. And so big improvements on dirt roads currently have to be approved by the Bureau of Land Management, and we recognize that. But the fact that the road exists and is the county's is not recognized by the BLM, and we would require that under this law.
Yeah. So some documentation and the like. So let's get to the here and now. This, you kind of hit on it, the fundamental issue here. My question, Bob, would be, who are the decision makers? Is this Congress, or where are the key points here in this process at this point in time?
Well, Congress has to clarify this, and that's the law that we have, the bill that we have before it right now. We've asked members to introduce it. That hasn't happened yet. We're still waiting to get past the current drama here in Washington.
Yeah. Does that bill have an assigned number?
No, not
okay,
yet.
Okay, not yet. Okay.
But we have, in the last two Congresses, we have had bills with bill numbers.
Okay.
And the resistance comes from the environmental groups who say, no, the counties are secretly trying to pave every dirt road in the West, when in fact, all they're trying to do is clarify that those roads that have always existed prior to 1976.
Now, let me just jump in there really quick, because that is absolutely true. The counties are not interested in making a whole lot of new roads. They're not interested in paving all of the roads, because we simply can't afford to pave them, nor can we afford to maintain
them. Yeah.
And so some of these scare tactics are simply ridiculous and would never come to fruition.
Yeah, I think we're going to do another table talk and address those in specifics. We just need to on that.
Yeah, we're about out of time, I think.
Yeah. So bill in the works. What's the current urgency then? I think this is here and now. This is the pinpoint of it. Bob, what's the current urgency here? What do citizens need to be aware of and maybe taking action on?
Well, the current urgency is that in order to prove that these roads existed prior to 1976, a living human being has to be able to testify and validate that that was the case. And as time goes on, they're dying off.
Yeah.
So the strategy of the environmental movement is to postpone this as long as possible so that all those who can validate that these roads were in use prior to 1976 die off.
So we'll get into this further in another table talk, but maybe we could just specify a few things. If you're an old timer, let's use that phrase, okay? An old timer still alive, you know about these. Steve, you can chip in here. Wouldn't it be helpful for them to get up there and do some video stuff right now and maybe video this old timer talking about, yes, I did this then and there and here. Is that going to help at all?
You know, that does help. And the state of Utah has been very aggressive and very active in this.
Right.
With an organization for public lands.
Mm-hmm.
And Kathleen Clark heads up that organization. And they have done a lot of testimony mm-hmm. with a lot of people around in every county. But there's been some specific requirements, and one of the requirements is the date they were born. They have now allowed us to bring that down to people that are now 65 years of age and older.
Okay.
And so that testimony continues to go on. But as far as anybody out there that could testify and falls within that criteria of being 65 or older, frankly, we would like to hear from them.
Yeah. I mean, we've urged that before. We need to urge it again. I was raised in southern Colorado, and I could tell them there about things up on our range right there, our grazing right. We had private land in amongst that, but I could, you know, things have changed since that was, you know, 60 years ago when I was roaming around up there, 55 years ago. And, you know, in southern Colorado, I could tell them lots of things that have some roads now that look like they're growing over. But back then, we were using them like crazy.
And we need to, and Bob's fighting the good fight on this. He really is. Bob, you're worth every penny we pay you.
So that's all the time we've really got today. But, Bob, I think we've got future ones coming up. We'll leave that to Steve to kind of, you know, we've got monthly editions here with the county on this. We can elaborate on that further and get into more details. We just need the listeners and the public to be aware of this, have some understanding of it. I mean, it's not on their everyday plate to understand this. That's why we have elected officials we have to rely on in many ways. And this one's certainly one of those. So, Bob, we appreciate your valuable time. I guess back there where you're at, you're going to be lunchtime here pretty soon. So,
yes, indeed. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.
You bet. That's
Thank you, Bob
Widener. Yeah. Here on our morning stretch. In conclusion, Steve.
The only thing I can say in conclusion is if you have the opportunity to, right now with the Democrats in control of the House, we have the opportunity in Senator Ben McAdams, who is a good man, and if anyone ever has the opportunity to write the senator or write the congressman, I apologize, if you can write Congressman McAdams and encourage him to help introduce a bill for RS-2477 roads and secure rural schools.
That's the phrase to use.
Yep.
RS-2477.
And if you need some language on that, we can wordsmith it so that you say it the right way. We certainly need your help.
All righty. So all particularly land users, and whether you use it recreationally, use it for agricultural purposes or whatever, get a hold of a county commission. They can help you out on that one for sure.
And keep in mind that this funds the schools. This funds our kids, and
we're just not talking about putting the cow out there. We're talking about impact for every person in the community.
Exactly, and we love the cows out on the range. We really do. Keep grazing.
Yeah, so thank you for your time this morning. Listeners, we appreciate you joining us on kind of a deep one again, but it's important to have some understanding on it here on our KMTI Table Talk.